You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, and today is Tuesday, September 6, 2011. Beer Sessions Radio is sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. To learn more about beer and test your beer knowledge, go to GreatBrewers.com. And we're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 34 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer. Check out GoodBeerSeal.com. Well, we've got one of the Good Beer Seal bar owners here, Ben Granger from Beercraft. He was recently elected into the group. And we got Kelly Taylor from Kelso, one of our favorite New York City brewers, in the house tonight. How are you guys?
Doing well. Thank you very much.
Outstanding.
How are you doing, Jimmy?
Well, you know, we had the hurricane that was. And the good side is that New York City was okay. But many of our friends upstate who were farmers up in Greene County and didn't do so well. Do you guys have any farmer friends upstate?
I've got a couple of people that we deal with up the Hudson Valley that didn't do too poorly. Actually, they seem to weather the storm pretty well. So I think overall, myself and people I know were fairly lucky.
Same here. Everybody that we talk to has been fairly lucky. I mean, our friends in Vermont, not so much.
Right,
but. But our people in upstate New York, we've been all right, very fortunate.
What did you guys do during the hurricane?
Well, I think in New York City, really, the hurricane hit Saturday night. We were kind of battening down the hatches and getting ready, and we got a keg of beer and a keg of water. Sonia and I were ready to roll, and it just kind of rained, and we were watching and waiting, and nothing really happened, and so we went to bed, and I think it rained all night. We got up in the morning, and it was just a little stormy. I think we slept through the whole thing, mm-hmm. realistically.
Well, what we did, the day before, I harvested my hops, and then the day of, my backyard likes to take on water, and then it likes to come in the back door, so I have a little pump set up out there. Unfortunately, the pump is not on a float trigger. It's turned on and off manually, so I stayed up for 24 hours drinking Heller High Watermelon, which I usually don't drink fruit beers, but I thought it was fitting at the time,
very good.
Until about 8:30 in the morning, turning on the pump, on, off, on, off, all night.
You should have got the clapper. So sit back, lean back in your chair, and be like, that way you don't have to put your beer down.
Where were you on Friday?
Really? I was filling a keg of Kelso IPA and getting ready for Armageddon.
So the hurricane came and went. Ben, you brought us some good beers. What did you bring for us today?
We brought some homebrew. Let's see, what did I bring? I brought a beer that we called Mellow Yellow.
Mmm.
Yeah.
So these are beers that you make yourself as homebrew. Do you sell these at Beercraft?
These are just homebrews. We don't sell these guys. This is a saison with lots of hops in it. So it's basically an IPA with a Belgian yeast.
Kelly, how do you feel? You drink a lot of beer. You're one of the top brewers that I know.
You're too kind.
How do you feel about,
these are really
drinking
small
homebrew?
Glasses.
you feel that homebrew has a lot to offer?
Definitely. I get some of my greatest inspiration from homebrews. I judge a lot of homebrew competitions. I started as a homebrewer in college many years ago, so I understand the creativity and the lack of handcuffs that go into making a homebrew. People just throw the book at it, and a lot of times I'm very impressed with, especially in the last few years, I've been very impressed with the quality and creativity that the homebrewers have been popping up with. for a while, it was a little rough. There's probably like three of you do a competition with 30 entries, and there'd be about three really good ones, and then a whole bunch that showed potential. And now it's kind of the other way around. It's really hard to kind of weed through the list of classic styles and creative, innovative styles. It's really exciting.
I agree. I think in the last couple of years, the homebrewing scene has kind of blossomed. Well,
yours have always been excellent.
Oh, Kelly.
Yeah, we're just going to sit around and pat each other on the back. Have a good time.
You guys fantastic. Are buddies. I like this show. Cheers to the buddies.
Kelly and Ben.
Well, all right. It's been a really interesting relationship because, you know, Beercraft has been kind of on the cutting edge of the New York City beer scene for over a decade. For almost 10 years. Which is great, which supersedes Kelso by 4 years. So.
Right, well, but that's cool.
So, Ben Granger, you're the Dean of Beer in New York City.
Dean of Beer.
Would you take that title?
I guess I would take that title.
I would sign that. I've heard him speak about beer.
If you were the Dean of Beer, what would you do? Give us 5 points that you would like to implement in New York City.
As the Dean of Beer? Well, on a serious note, I'd like to see some cleaner lines. I'd like to see some cleaner lines. I'd like to see a little more diversity in the lineups in some of the bars in the city. And I would demand that every household consume at least 6 beers a day. That's a household. That's not per person. That's a household. I would also have to say, fourth point as Dean of Beer, I would have to say we should be able to walk the street with a beer.
Ooh, good one. I like that one.
I think, you know, it's something to be said about having a beer outside while taking a walk. And the last point, I would like to see, as a fifth point, we'll have to come back to it.
That's pretty good. I like that.
I would like to see some rooftop grain gardens, actually.
Interesting.
Instead of, because everybody's trying to grow hops on their rooftops, I think it would actually be kind of cool to look out across the city and see all the rooftops have like heads of hair.
Yeah.
Like growing grain. I think that would be kind of cool.
What do you think about that, Kelly?
I think that's great. I really like to be able to walk down the street with a beer. It's like kind of go down to New Orleans and you get a nice glass of beer, which there are actually some great breweries down there now.
For sure.
And you can walk down the street and not get hassled. And as long as
you know, there could be definitely decorum. You know, there could be rules. You could walk down the street with the beer.
Yeah.
You could not harass anyone. You know?
Well, you know,
and
just,
if you did anything with the beer, anything cool. That was really bad, right. You got twice the punishment.
Right.
So you'd be rewarded if you behave properly. Yeah. You could walk down the street with a beer.
Well, and I like the draft line cleanliness thing because I think a lot of places slack on that. And pouring your beer with mixed gas or pure CO2 as opposed to some places pour it with air.
Yeah,
pouring it with a Guinness gas mix it's not a Guinness beer, and they're not doing the right pressure. So basically, you wind up pouring flat beer.
I would like to see more.
Are you saying that some establishments don't get proper gas?
A lot of places don't have the right gas mix for what they're trying to do. So if you're pouring with pure CO2. If you don't have the right pressure on there, the beer can become overcarbonated over time and start to gush and be foamy. Or if you're pouring with the Guinness gas canister, which is the 75% nitrogen, that doesn't keep the beers carbonated enough, and they wind up flattening out over time. So the top pressure on the keg balances the carbonation in the beer. And you can kind of get away with it because there are a lot of different carbonation levels in beers. If you just kind of hit the middle road and target what your bar needs to get the beer out the tap, that's a special kind of balance. And you can't just do pure CO2 or Guinness gas in every situation. Some cases it's optimal. In many cases it's not.
It's true. I mean, when you run pure CO2, you really you have to babysit. Well, actually, with either situation, you have to babysit. You have to be a little bit on top of your game. That's something I would like to see. I would like to see people use use more of a draft technician in their specific situation, because we run straight CO2.
Right, but your draw is like a foot and a half.
Yeah, my draw is like very short.
Yeah, so your top pressure is what, about 5-8 psi?
Well, because we split the lines.
Yeah.
So I have one line that goes to the faucet and one line that goes to the filler. So, and I want the filler to go fast and the faucet to be calm. So we manipulate the situation, so to speak.
Right.
we have a couple of tricks that we pull. But I feel like, you know, if you pay attention to your beer, you kill the gas every night, you do, you know, there's a couple of things that you do, you know, to keep from pushing past a good level of saturation, you know, in your beer.
To keep the beer from being foamy.
Yeah. So right. To keep it from being overcarbonated.
Right.
You know? So, but I also feel like, you know, with nitro, with blended gas, you know, it's easier to, in our opinion, it's easier to take beer out, take gas out than to put it back in.
Right.
You know, and if you're pushing with a blended gas, it's always going to lose a little bit. As it sits, it's always going to push back against
that blended
gas. When we're
talking about the Guinness gas, which is mostly nitrogen.
Yeah, which is mostly nitrogen. Yeah, there's not a lot of CO2, and you need like gas to keep it in saturation. You need more CO2 to keep the CO2 in saturation.
Let's take a step back, because you lost me, which I'm probably midway in beer knowledge. So.
I am midway.
Right. You guys are way above me. How about this? Let's go back to the old days. When they first started making beer in the 1800s, forget
which
the story.
Which
about
is not when they first started making beer, but I got you.
Yeah, it's no Mesopotamian stuff. Right. But nice. Okay, it's the 1800s, and you go into a pub in England, and they had cask beer. Mm-hmm. You had made fresh beer, and they would like put it in the cask, and it was ready. They poured it out, maybe a gravity pour, some kind of a pump, like one of those old fashioned water pumps. Mm-hmm. So how did they go from that to making Guinness? That's what I want to know. Because in my mind, Guinness is an industrial version of what natural beer should be. And that's all. I'm going on.
Well,
a whole
that's the nitrogenation, that those nitro pours, the classic Guinness faucet pushed, low carbonated beer pushed with high pressure through a special faucet, churns it up. It simulates that old style of pouring the beer on the beer engines and the creaminess.
Flattens the beer.
Yeah, it makes the beer. The key with the cask beer, the beer engine, the nitro pour, is to have a flat beer with a creamy head so that your palate thinks the beer is creamy and not flat.
Basically the Guinness style is, it's more of an industrial version.
Yeah. It's a consistency.
The cask ale.
It's a consistent version. It's a version that if you do the mix right, it's very tricky to do, but it's being pushed with gas instead of air, because those old cask engines were pushed with air, which makes the beer age immediately,
mm-hmm.
Kind of like opening a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer or a bottle of Coca-Cola.
Or anything.
Yeah, anything. You know,
as you're exposed to oxygen.
As soon as you open it, and it starts to flatten out and all this other stuff. But with the Guinness and the nitro pours, and when you talk Guinness, you talk Beamish and you're talking all those other nitrogen beers. But that's just a consistent, you can have that on tap for a week, the same keg on tap, and it's going to taste the same at the beginning as it does at the end versus the cask condition stuff and the beer engine stuff that's poured with air isn't going to taste the same. It's going to taste different tomorrow, and it better be gone by the third day. Now, there's ways you can do the cask condition stuff and the beer engine stuff now with the makeup air being nitrogen, and the casks don't go so stale so quickly, but it's not as consistent as the Guinness.
This is true. I mean, you're right, though, Jimmy. I see what you're saying. It's like
I'm used to making stuff up. I'm not used to having it. Check right. Oh, here we're trying one of these.
I like your saison, but let's try some of one of Kelly's beers.
Yeah, let's try one of mine.
Yeah, so I see what you're saying, though, as a kind of an industrial version of cask ale, like a modernized version of it.
You know, I've thought that for a while, and it's good that we finally said it on the air. Thank you. Because the other thing, because with when you're drinking cask beer, it's like, well, then there's no gas issues, and we've only talked about
sure you do. You have oxygen intake,
yeah,
and
oxygen
you have
intake
the beer.
Well, if you're but like forget. Let's just say, imagine you had this pure cask of beer and you just tapped it and you drank. You know,
but what happens when you tap a brand new cask beer?
Oh, it's fresh.
It's fresh. It's frothy.
It's got gas.
It's frothy. It's carbonated. It's gassy. It's lively.
It's exciting.
Yeah. In fact, they call it live.
Yeah.
You know, that beer is very live because it's got a lot of stuff going on with it. And over the course of time, that diminishes and it calms down, but it should have a frothiness to it. You're asking what this
is?
That's
what we like. Yeah.
This smells awesome.
This is our bourbon barrel aged Recessionator Doppelbock. 8% Doppelbock aged in Heaven Hill bourbon barrels for 3 months.
It's silky.
Yeah, Ben, do that again. Do your thing. You did the...
That's amazing.
That's good, yeah.
Ben Granger.
Yeah. Here for sound effects.
This is part of our barrel aging program. We have some bourbon barrels. We have some brandy barrels. We have some Cabernet barrels and some Jack Daniel's barrels that we got directly from the distillery. And we're just taking a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and kind of aging them up. And eventually, once we get all the... You know, you can reuse the barrel, and every time you use it, you lose flavor. And eventually, when you're not really getting the flavors anymore, you we're just doing sour aging.
Yeah, I was just actually going to ask
you. Sound effect. Dude, this is really good.
It is good. It's delicious. I was just going to ask you how many times, you know, how many uses you get out of the barrel.
Well, it depends on the barrel and the freshness of the wood when you first get it in. You know, the Heaven Hill stuff we get in, and it's still got bourbon in it. Just a little bit, and
delicious.
I have to try to keep that away from my brewers when we get in because they like attack it and like try to pull the growlers out and drain it, and it's like, let's leave a little bit of that in there, you know, so you can reuse those 3 or 4 times and still get some of the bourbon flavor. Though the length of time you need to leave the beer in there almost increases logarithmically every time you use
it. You know? When they show up with bourbon in them, do you guys say? I always thought, you know, like if it shows up with bourbon in it, you almost like it shows up with sterilizer. So do you save the bourbon and then on the second use, dump it back in and roll it around and then?
No, we save it. If we're going to save it, really what I want to do is leave some in there.
Yeah.
I just want to leave it in there. Yeah. Just put the beer in it. Because then you really just kind of put the beer in there a couple days later, take it out, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
If we do take any out, it usually winds up in our coffee. You know, because, you know,
we're
human. Is that a
morning coffee or an evening coffee?
Well, that's morning coffee. Especially mornings like this. It's a little dull, gray, 62 degrees.
Need a little pick-me-up.
Yeah, pick-me-up and my pick-me-up.
Yeah, a little pick-me-up and my pick-me-up.
You guys are awesome. Ben, can we get the sound effect one more time?
Yeah. I actually have to drink to make it happen.
Oh, bummer.
Love that.
That's good. That's pretty.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with our guests and find out about New York Craft Beer Week on Beer Sessions Radio.
You hold my hand, and I can't understand my nerves. Oh, my nerves. One look from you, and you don't know what you do to my nerves. Oh, my nerves. You hold me tight and kiss me right, my nerves, oh my nerves. I get such a thrill, it sends a chill to my nerves, oh my nerves. Can't you see what you do to me to have me feel this way? I pat my feet and I clap my hands and I snap my fingers all day. Low, that you love me so, my nerves, oh my nerves. I should be bold when I lose control of my nerves, oh my nerves.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a great radio network. You can tune in pretty much 24/7. Shows from cheese to farming, and chefs, and our Beer Sessions Radio, which I'm having a great time with Ben Granger from Beer Craft and Kelly Taylor from Kelso in New York City. All right, guys. So we made it through the hurricane, and we've been talking about things like cask beer and this great new Heaven Hill Bourbon aged beer. What is this beer that we're drinking again, Kelly?
This is the Kelso Recessionator, which is an 8% alcohol Doppelbock. that actually we came up with a couple years ago, and unfortunately we can still use the name. I was thinking about changing the name Recessionator once we pulled out, but maybe next year. So it's that Double Bock aged in Heaven Hill bourbon barrels for a number of weeks.
This is an awesome beer.
Thank you.
And Ben, I'm going to give Ben a little kudo here. Ben is the dean of beer. We announced that tonight.
Yes.
And you guys have something special going on. It's you're coming up on your 10th year anniversary.
Yeah, we're going to be 10 years old in November.
And what are you doing with Kelly and Kelsa?
Well, we have a ton of stuff going on, but one of our main attractions is we had a contest at the shop. And all of our customers voted on what they would like our anniversary beer to be. And Imperial Stout was the winner. We haven't drawn the, because out of all the Imperial Stout votes, we're drawing a name out of a hat, and that person will go and brew the beer with Kelly. And, that's that. And it's going to be an Imperial Stout, and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, should be pretty entertaining. You know, they approached us and said, you know, what do you think about doing a anniversary beer for us? And I said, that's a great idea. Why don't we throw it open to the customers and let's have fun with it.
It kind of went like that. It went more like this. Hey, Kelly, do you want to brew an anniversary beer for us? And Kelly said, yeah, why don't you guys have a raffle and somebody will vote. Everybody will vote on the style. And then you pull a name out of a hat and that person will come brew the beer with. He basically just gave us the whole idea.
No, I think we were working on it together. It was a collaboration project.
You had a 20-second collaboration.
Well, we've known each other for a long time.
This is true. That's very true.
So you guys have done this before?
Not the collaboration.
Never?
No.
First
time. No, they're very good at putting on random stuff that I make. You know, which is fun because I can make something and experiment and say, well, I don't know if I want to like release it to the general market. Let's just release it to the people that, you know, will understand it more so maybe than I do. And there's a very short list of people, and Ben's on the top of it.
Well, we really like his beer. I like that you made putting on good beer a skill set for me. That's good. Thank you for that. So yeah, we've never actually done an exclusive or anything, but we've always had like you know something cool. There's always something cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really nice because I think I walked it and it was about a mile.
Yeah, you carried the beer over.
Yeah, I carried the beer. You know, it was like a mile from the brewery, and a lot of the stuff that we've done has been like, why don't we just put a bunch of random stuff into a cask and then just walk it over to you? Or they'll send their truck over and pick it up, and just kind of utilize the fact that, you know, this is one of the beauties of brewing local, right, is you can develop a relationship. The retailer can develop a relationship with the brewer and make something kind of eclectic and one-off and have fun with it and you highlight the freshness and complexity and diversity of local craft beer and really just kind of take it to that next level.
Yeah.
So you did that oyster shuck.
Oh, yeah. When we opened our backyard this past spring. And it was our first time, so we had an oyster shuck. So we had this huge oyster event and had all these oysters, and Kelly made an oyster stout for us. And we had 8 casks in the backyard. I built the cask rack, and everybody's hanging out and drinking. And you like, you know, our customers usually, it's the pale ale and the IPA is the first thing to go. The oyster stout was gone hours before anything else. Hours.
That was excellent.
I want that beer.
It was great. Well, I just went to the corner fishmonger and picked up a couple pounds of Blue Points. And I'm doing a 10-gallon pilot batch. And I just read up on the old world way of doing an oyster stout. And there was a lot of different ways to do it and a lot of different theories about how it was supposed to work. And I was like, I'm just going to do it old school and a way that I'm sure Ben would appreciate and just take a bunch of oysters and throw them into the damn beer and cook it up.
Do you shuck them first or
nope.
Throw the whole thing?
Throw the whole thing in. They're self-shucking.
They shuck themselves.
They shuck themselves. We tried one after we pulled it out. Not recommended. They do not taste very good after they've been boiled in sweet wort. It's really kind of disgusting.
Rubbery and...
It was just like rubbery. This rubbery kind of charred... ugh.
So what if I pour my oyster stout and I get a little piece of cooked oyster? Would that happen?
No.
No.
Absolutely not. Not with the strict quality controls that we have at the Kelso Brewery Company.
I would say that like the average person does not realize all the cool things that go into beers. You're making an oyster stout. What are some other really cool stuff that you have coming down the pipeline?
Well, obviously the barrel aged stuff that we've got. We have some fresh hop projects that we're working with Blue Hill Stone Barns up in Westchester. They have a hop field up there at this point, you know, a dozen plants or so, and we just got about 15 pounds of fresh hops from them, and we're going to be putting that in a variety of different kegs, doing some fresh hop kegged beer for their Harvest Fest, which is also that same weekend.
Oh, right.
Everybody's Harvest Fest is the 1st and 2nd of October,
which is
kind of weird. It corresponds with the harvest, I guess. So, you know, this time of year is a really interesting time of year, because then you start doing the pumpkin beers and the fest beers, and you're getting out of the wit beer and the Pilsner summertime stuff.
Have you done a pumpkin beer?
We have not.
Yeah.
No. I brew some pumpkin beer. I brew a pumpkin beer for Heartland Brewery, which is my other job is Heartland Brewery. And I think it's one of the best pumpkin beers on the market, and I don't really know. You know, one of the things that I try to
do is, we had it 2 years ago, the Heartland Pumpkin. It was awesome.
I think it's a great beer, and I don't know how to do it any differently for Kelso, so I just don't do it.
Oh, I see. I try to do it different.
You know, I try to do all the Kelso beers different from the Heartland beers.
Right.
And sometimes I wind up not doing one because it's going to conflict with another one. It's kind of a thing I've got. So
you definitely walk the fine line. I mean, you're amazing, dude. You contract brew for First People.
Right.
You make your own label, and you also make the beer for Heartland.
Well,
and you have integrity
the beer
with
business.
Each, man.
You know, just awesome, make beer dude. As much as possible. That's my thing, is make as much beer. It's a long way from when I was brewing it when I was 18 in my college dorm room, that's for sure.
I'm sure. Unless your college dorm room, you had 60 barrel fermenters in there. Probably not.
No. So we have a call-in question. Who's on the line?
Hey, my name is Jason.
Hi, Jason. Where are you from?
I'm actually over here in Seattle, Washington.
All right.
Yeah. So I had a great question for you guys. Obviously, long-time listener and first-time caller. But I wanted to ask you guys a question, being that I'm still somewhat of a new to home brewing. I'm having some problems when it comes to the amount of material that is left over in each of my bottles. No, I shouldn't say left over. That's in each of my bottles of beer that I'm brewing, specifically this red that I keep brewing. I'm adding so many hops based on the recipe that I've kind of, you know, tweaked and contorted to be the great taste that I love. But I come across it whenever I pour it into a glass. There's so much leftover hops in there, and I'm a pellet hop user still. I haven't moved to the full flake. I didn't know if there was any recommendations at how to reduce that, but yet still getting all that full flavor that I want out of the hops.
Well, as a home brewer, I'm Ben, by the way. As a home brewer, one of the things that we do is we kind of make a little whirlpool in the kettle when we're knocking out into the fermenter. So mm-hmm. what you do is you get the liquid moving with the paddle, and it starts to set up the all those kind of particulates from the pellets right around the dip tube. So it creates like a filter bed. So you get some, but you know you don't get all of it. You don't get so much. The other thing, the only other way to get that particulate out of there is really to filter, you know.
What's a good way for a home brewer to filter? Economically filter without going like all crazy.
Right. Are you do you keg it all, or is it just bottles?
Oh, we're just doing bottles right now. I mean, we obviously do growlers and bottles and stuff like that. So we haven't moved to the keg yet system, but we're still brewing out of like a six gallon brew kettle. And I'm thinking in my head too. I'm like one of those logical problem solvers. I want to stick some type of like filter. Like I'm thinking, would I throw it into the carboy to siphon it out, or not from the carboy into the kettle when I'm siphoning into the carboy or into the bucket for the primary fermentation? I want to put something in there that's leaving that particulate out of where I'm going into.
I would probably throw a filter, just a couple layers of cheesecloth, on the end of the wort chiller on its way into the fermenter. That way, when it passes through it, it'll break it up a little bit. You'll oxygenate the wort a little bit, and which is good for pre-fermentation, and you'll help remove some of those particulates.
And also, I'm thinking, are you able to chill down the? Are you transferring into secondary fermentation, or are you just taking everything right out of the carboy?
No, I use a primary and a secondary.
You do a primary and a secondary. Are you able to refrigerate the secondary?
Not yet.
Yeah, I mean, you're in Seattle. You could probably just put it outside at night or something.
we just leave the windows open.
Just kind of put it over by the door. But you know, if you can get that cold somehow, whether you know putting it in your beer fridge that you got in the backyard or in the garage, or put it in the backyard overnight, try to chill it down. That'll create a flocculation and a downward movement on the yeast and particulates, and that'll help kind of pre-clarify it. Yeah, that's another thought.
Kelly, will that yeast, as it's crashing out, will that help to pull particles out of the suspension?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that'll help create a downward flow, and everything will kind of pull out.
Kelly, how about this? When there's someone starting out in home brewing, and you know maybe that's the first couple of years because they're still cutting their chops, do you think they should start with some simpler beer recipes?
Absolutely not. I think you should brew whatever you want.
I love that.
For real, when you're starting off at homebrewing, just throw the book at it. You know, and I do recommend getting a book. I always recommend The Complete Joy of Homebrewing by Charlie Papazian. That's what I started with because at the end of every chapter, he says, relax, don't worry, have a homebrew. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good moniker. It's a good thing to remember because at the end of the day, no matter how much sanitizing you're doing and how much recipes you're trying to be true to style, you're trying to be completely wacky or whatever, at the end of the day, you're making beer. It's all good. You know, so in these books, they go through basic build your own kits all the way through. Oh, here's the top of the line homebrewing equipment you can buy. Here's the all grain recipes. Here's the extract recipes. They do everything. It's a good guide to kind of help keep you confident in what you're doing and having fun with it.
You guys got time for a second question then?
Sure, man. And also stay on with us, man. If you want, you can stay on for the rest of the show.
There we go. Hey. Why is it that every time I come out to the East Coast, and my brother lives on the East Coast, and I have a couple other family relatives that live out there, I can never find a good red ale? Now, I'm not talking like an Irish red, but like a good just red ale like we have over here on the West Coast.
Why can't you find? Well, I think there's some good red ales out here. You know, it's just the market out here is a little bit different. I think what you want to ask is, what do you define a good red ale as? I think there's some good red ales out here, but they're not hoppy. They're malty. They're really
malt
forward.
Yeah, and I think that it's the balance between the hoppy and the malty that really stands out on the Northwest ones that I've had.
Sure. In my opinion, the Northwest ones are a little hop forward. They're a little more hoppy than we're going to have out here. And it's just a different animal. I'm trying to think of
like, other thing that's different
well,
too. Is
good, I think East Coast.
It's East Coast. We look also to Europe more, I think. And when you say red ale, to me, I'm thinking Flemish red or like a sour beer. So I think that there's a lot more. We also get a lot more European beers here in the East Coast as well.
That's true.
Red ale is actually that's my favorite style of beer.
My
personal favorite. Mostly because exactly what you were saying. Like, there's this really, like, in a good red ale, there's a depth of malt character, you know, that is carrying some incredible hop aroma and good bitterness. So a good red ale is hard to find all around, but I hear what you're saying. On the East Coast, like Kelly was saying, it's the market's a little bit different, and there aren't quite as many red ales. You know, most of what we find out here that is pretty solid red. Ithaca makes a very solid red ale called Cascazilla, and then a lot of the stuff from the Midwest I find to be super delicious.
Do you like Founders Red?
Yeah, like Red's Rye. Yeah, I was just gonna say Founders Red's Rye, but my personal all time favorite is the Port Brewing Company, the Shark Attack, their Imperial Red.
Where's that from, bro?
That's West Coast.
West
that's California.
Yeah.
And that's a delicious. Have you had that? Anybody?
I've had that. Oh. Yeah. I went to college in San Diego and very
Jason.
Familiar with those.
I've not had Port's Shark Attack. I've had Bridge Ports, which is in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. They have a red. Elysian Brewery, which is up here in Seattle, they do a men's room red. And then my favorite's Georgetown Breweries over here in Seattle again. They do one called the Chopper Red, and then they do a Super Chop, which is a double Imperial Red that they do, which is even crazier good. I can't really describe it too much other than I just pretty much an explosion in my pants and my mouth.
Yeah.
uh,
Yeah, we don't have those reds here.
That's East Coast. Amazing. You don't get the explosion.
The Pant Explosion Red. That's a good beer name.
Yeah, there we go. Well, thank you guys for answering the questions. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back, and I don't know if we'll get Pants Explosion, but Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Listen to me, baby. I tell you how I love you. Well, you could throw me in the ocean. I'd swim to the bank and crawl right home to you. Yeah. Ain't I love you, baby?
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com, and check out GoodBrewSteel.com. Learn more about beer. Forget about these websites. We got Ben Granger from BeerCraft and Kelly Taylor from Kelso. All you need to know about beer here on Beer Sessions Radio.
So BeerCraft.com. Kelso
Beer. BeerCraft.com? Really?
Yeah, it's BeerCraft.com.
You guys have websites and everything?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Modern.
This is the happiest I've been in a long time. On air. I've got these two guys, and we got someone else on air right now who wants to ask more questions. Who's this?
Hey, how you doing?
Who's this, and where are you calling from?
Oh, this is Mike from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, long-time listener, first-time caller. And I just had a question about the difference between a Berliner Weiss and a German Goes. Mm. If you guys could elaborate on that, and also maybe some commercial examples of, like, you know, stuff that's out there.
Wow.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
I think this is Mike Lavulo from Union Beer.
Yeah,
who's like one of the other deans of beer.
Yeah.
That's funny. I mean, exactly. Berliner Weiss. Well, the thing is that, you know, traditionally, Kelly, correct me if I decide to screw this up along the way, Gose should go through a pre-lactic fermentation like a Berliner Weiss. It should go through a primary lactic fermentation. But the thing is that with Berliner Weiss, you're driving the lactic acid a little bit harder as opposed to the Gose. So, you know, with a Berliner Weiss, you know, it's going to be decidedly tart. You know, because you're getting a lactic fermentation even before there's an alcoholic fermentation. So you're letting the mash sit for X amount of time. All the lactic cultures that are on the mash, that are on the grains, start fermenting, converting long chain sugars into lactic acid. And then after that, it's racked out into the kettle, boiled, the cultures are killed, hops are added, et cetera, et cetera. So you're starting off with an acidity, but the flavor should be decidedly acidic, whereas Gose also should go through a lactic fermentation in a very similar fashion, but the amount of lactic acid that's going to be in the final product shouldn't be quite as high. It should be really an accent to the salt and coriander, which are the other two components that are going to separate Gose from Berliner Weiss. So its tartness should not be, you know, it shouldn't be sour. It should be a little tart, a little bright, actually, is the best way to put it.
Ben, how do you think these styles started? I mean, to us, we think of sour beer. That sounds
accidentally
crazy.
Accidentally. I mean, it's, you know, not being, I think it's accidentally because most lactic fermentation, especially this type of lactic fermentation, is spontaneous. So, like, it's just kind of happened, you know? And I'm sure at one point, you know, almost all beer was tart and smoky, you know. Now with the lactic fermentation, I'm sure it was, you know, accidental. And plus, when you have lactic fermentation and alcoholic fermentation and acetic fermentation as well, all three are sterilizing. All three are making the liquid drinkable because you're driving your lactic acid drives down the pH, which makes it more acidic, which means less funky stuff can live in there. You know, yeast makes alcohol, et cetera, et cetera.
Cool. Well, dude, thanks a lot, man. That was that was a lot more than I knew about lacto fermentation.
Was the difference between goes and goose?
Goes is German. Goes is salt, coriander.
There you go.
And
so we missed the whole question.
It's like, there's like two. There's like two.
Well, no, I heard that, but I didn't know.
He was saying the goes, the German style goes, and the German style Berliner Weiss. He wasn't saying goose. He was saying goes.
We made a goes at the shop.
But it's not just a German way of spelling a Flemish.
No. It's a specific style of beer, salt and coriander. We made one at the shop a couple weeks ago.
How do you spell
it? G-O-Z-E.
G-O-Z-E.
Yeah. Goes. Like steady as she goes.
Is it salty?
It shouldn't be. We made one and it was, but it shouldn't be salty.
Have you ever heard anybody brewing a beer with salt as a primary flavoring component?
Yeah, goes. Well,
besides, on purpose?
No, you should. I think if...
I'm working with Mama Fuko in developing a recipe for their restaurants, and one of the flavoring components that they were talking about earlier today was salt. And they're thinking about like
make a goat.
I think
make
I might.
Goes, man.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. We made one at the shop a couple of months ago. Actually, we used the second runnings of another beer that I brought for our goats, but we let it sit for 5 days.
That is the most random transition.
Well, what are the odds?
when you were talking about goats versus Berliner Weiss, I zoned out. I was like, oh yeah, goose and. Right. And I love goes. I love the German style.
I love goose.
The German style of sour beers are awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
As many other styles of German beers are.
And as we're doing that, we're talking about that, we're drinking our Flemish Red, which is a sour.
Which we are actually, during the break, we were chatting about this Flemish
which
Red.
They're all, beer. These are most like the original beers ever.
The beers that you brought in tonight, you brought in that great, the bourbon barrel aged...
Recessionator.
Right. And now it's also an aged Flemish Red.
This is 3-year-old Flemish Red.
Are these just from your private stash, or do you actually sell these anywhere?
Well, we have a small stash of them, but we usually hold them for events like the Brewer's Choice that's coming up in a couple weeks.
Yeah, for the New York Craft Beer Week.
New York Craft Beer Week.
September 22nd.
Yeah,
awesome.
That's right. Yeah, so we're saving some of that. We have aging with cherries in Tuthill Town rye barrels. Flemish Red, rye barrel, cherry aged.
Now you're just showing off.
I don't even know. I'm just pulling words out of the air. It's all in there, and it'll be on tap at the Brewer's Choice. You have to check it out online.
So 3-year-old Flemish Red.
With
cherries.
With cherries.
In a Tuttle Hill Town rye barrel.
Yes, correct.
Wow.
That'll be fun.
Ben, what's your little the thing you do on air now?
Oh, hey.
Wait for it.
I love it. That's amazing. All right. So we did goes for this is what this is so cool. Wow, goes and Berliner Weiss.
Yeah, what did you bring? You said that there was a segue there somehow.
Yeah,
it was remarkable.
I tried. You like that segue?
Yeah, I did. How did you go from goes to what you brought?
Well, we did basically a double brew. Here, let me finish this.
There are so many great styles of beer.
People talk about wine.
I mean, there's like at least 1,000 different grapes for wine. How many different styles of beer do you think there are?
I think there's like 222,000. I don't know. Beer's been around longer than most food. It's the oldest beverage in the world besides water. And... which is pretty old.
That's pretty old.
How many different styles are there? People are coming up with new styles all the time. So I think that's a moving target. But it's definitely one of the most complex, interesting, diverse, dynamic beverages you're going to come across ever. Because of the grain component, the hops, the water, the different yeasts, the bacteria, the wood aging, the whole nine yards. You could do one ingredient combination and do it 100 different ways and get 100 different beers and then just multiply that by, hundreds. It's like Carl Sagan, billions and billions.
Is that number 222,000?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, well, it's metric.
This show really worked out great. Kelly's wife, Sonia, Jacoby was going to come in tonight. She couldn't make it.
Right.
And you usually get Sonya or you get Kelly, which is either That's one. Right. You guys are awesome. Patrick Donaher from Get Real New York and some other place. Rattle and Hum was going to come in. Yeah. He always blows us off.
Yeah.
Patrick, you blew us up, but that's okay, because guess what? Because of that, we got to get this awesome love fest between Ben and Kelly.
And Jimmy.
And what and I
Jimmy.
Want... No.
Next time, you got to wear some clothes, Jimmy.
I know. The hurricane just robbed me of my dignity. But what I want to know, when is this 10th anniversary beer going to be available, and when's the party? Because you guys are fucking great together. Oops. And I want to see what you guys do together. This is cool.
Well, the party will start November 1st and end... How many days are there in November?
30.
November 30th.
See, only he knows the answers to your questions.
That's amazing.
Was that right?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I'm sticking to... If it's right now.
From now on.
Yeah.
Wow, this is really interesting.
So you're going to drink that beer, and you don't know what it is yet. It's a 10-year anniversary. It's going to be...
It's an imperial
style. Style, but yet you haven't made it. So.
Yeah, we haven't made it.
It could be,
it'll be an imperial style.
Could be something fun.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Does it have to be an imperial style? You might change the style.
Well, I think. I mean, yeah, we just have a contest. We're like, you know what? We're gonna do a blonde.
Wow, this imperial
a blonde
stout
imperial
is
stout.
Is,
yeah,
clear,
we're gonna do an imperial mild stout.
That's not a bad idea.
And where will this beer be available? Only at Beercraft, or is it going to be like citywide, or all the Good Beer Seal bars?
I don't know. What do you think? What do you think?
I think you should make and sell it at the Good Beer Seal bars. And
we're very open.
Both Beercraft and Kelso, man. Come on, let's do it.
I'm not a big fan of the exclusive thing. I like the beer to get out there.
You should
people
make
to
it at least
beer.
For like 30 or 40 bars. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. The Good Beer Seal.
We'd love to have it. And we can also like give our hats off to Beercraft, 10 years.
Sure, yeah. This is
our brother.
Yeah, trailblazer.
High five.
Really. Yeah, I'm up for that. I'm up for whatever.
Yeah, I'm down. Totally down. So I'm looking forward to drinking it, really.
Yeah. I think the next step, really, is we should, and I know this is going to be tricky, but we should go in and to your place and taste some imperial stouts and figure out what kind of one we want to try to emulate.
That sounds like a great idea.
And tweak somehow.
That's my favorite part of brewing is the
R&D
research that goes into it.
That's right.
Yeah. Sit down and have a few.
What is this again?
This was Carl's recipe. Carl's a guy who works for us, a good friend of mine. It's his Newark style IPA. It's actually a pre-prohibition recreation of Ballantine IPA, aged on oak. The only thing that's not pre-prohibition is the strain of hop in the dry hop. Everything else is pretty straightforward.
Kelly, before the show, we touched on pre-prohibition beer in New York, in America. People said beer used to be good. Beer was always good. It was better. What was going on?
Well, right.
Yeah.
Say pre-prohibition, there was so many different factors involved with, but all beer was made locally. There was more breweries in the United States before prohibition than there are now. And most of the reason for that is that the beer was made locally. It was made at the corner bar. It was made at the corner brewery, and it wasn't distributed very far. Mainly because there wasn't refrigerated transport, there wasn't pasteurization, there wasn't tight filtration, things that you need to ensure quality over shipping distances. And also, there wasn't a U.S. interstate highway system. Yeah, so there was no way to really move beer. And beer is a very delicate beverage. That's why I always say drink local, wherever you happen to be, because beer is very delicate and it just does not want to be transported over long distances necessarily. There's some exceptions to that.
Hear, hear, man.
Yeah,
totally.
But
drink
pre-prohibition, it was drink local. And then there was prohibition, then there was a Dust Bowl, there was a Great Depression, all kinds of things that just decimated the U.S. economy, decimated the crops that were grown in this economy and what the crops were used for. And then after prohibition, people had no money. Barley was extremely expensive and being utilized mostly for food, not for brewing. So the brewers, after prohibition, had to find a way to make a beer that people could afford. And in order to do that, they couldn't use barley, so they wound up using a lot of rice and some other adjuncts, not high-quality two-row barley that people used to use. And that made a beer that was alcoholic and inexpensive. And that's where the big breweries got their foothold in right after Prohibition. And I think I've also read where that was right after Prohibition. Then there was World War II, and most of the drinking age men went overseas, and the people that were left were people that, you know, women and people that weren't drinking a lot of beer. They didn't want something that was necessarily really strong and hearty and, you know, really gruff. They wanted something a little bit lighter and more refreshing after working in the factories all day. And that just gained popularity and gained the market share of these breweries. So that's what we got kind of stuck with. And again, the United States is unique in that economy. You go anywhere else in the world, places have had breweries for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I'm talking anywhere. I know one of our guys that works for us as a delivery driver, he's from Africa. And he's like, oh, yeah, there's this little corner brewery that's been there for 200 years down by the river in Gambia, I think it is. But, you know, every country has its own brewery that's been there for you know, hundreds of years. And we kind of lost that in this country. And it's really nice to see us going back to local breweries.
I think it was Frank Zappa who said, to be a country, you have to have a brewery.
He was a very smart man. So he's still alive.
A brewery, an airport, and an army, I think, were the three things. I'm not sure. But brewery was number one.
In that order?
I'm not sure.
That's
not
debatable.
Sure. That is debatable. So, but I know brewery. I know.
Add that, Ben, to your list of things as Dean of Beer.
Yeah, to be a country, you have to have a brewery.
How about a city? New York City's got
absolutely.
All that.
Well,
you know,
actually,
you guys are coming back. Listen,
New York City.
Brett's our booker now, and Brie O'Connor, our producer. You guys are coming back. We're going to talk more about this, and we're definitely going to talk more about the pre-prohibition beers and changes that happened after. I never heard about how the interstate highway impacted, our beer industry. Interesting. But we're going to give a little shout out to some good beer seal events and the New York City Craft Beer Week, which is coming upon us. It's starts on September 16th. There's quite a few events, including Get Real in New York, and our special event, which Beer Sessions Radio, Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger are producing, and Kelly Taylor is going to be at, Garrett Oliver is going to be there. The New York City Brewers' Choice, check out nycbrewerschoice.com, and it's probably the best event of New York Craft Beer Week. Ben's going to be there from Beercraft as well. And check it out, nycbrewerschoice.com. Make sure you get your New York City Craft Beer Week passports. Go to nycbeerweek.com. And anything else happening for Craft Beer Week at Beercraft, Ben?
We do specials all week long. So we'll have discounts on all New York State brewed products, as well as a solid draft list of New York beers, plus our Tuesday and Thursday events.
All right. That sounds great. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Also, check out Good Beer Seal, goodbrewerseal.com. Thanks again to Ben and Kelly. And for joining us here on Heritage Radio Network, I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and our guest coordinator, Brett Thompson. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
The following is a message from NOFA NY. Do you dig local food? Love organic farmers? Do you crave to be part of a growing movement of consumers concerned with the state of our nation's food system? Then sign up today to take the NOFA NY's Locavore Challenge this September. Join 5,000 other New York locavores that are hungry, active, and ready to change our food system. Learn more at www.nylocavorechallenge.com.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.